So associated to the states and operators of loop quantum gravity, we can define phase spaces which are associated to the graphs gamma. Now these phase spaces are representing the kinematics of gravity, so it's natural to try and assign some spatial geometry to them. So there are three attempts I know of that go towards this direction. There's twisted geometries developed by Simone and Laurent a few years ago. And more recently, in this paper with Mark and Laurent and myself, we found two different gauges of continuous geometries that are both isomorphic to P gamma. The problem with these is that twisted geometries are discontinuous. You cannot assign a continuous frame field to them. The singular geometries, well, they're singular, so that's not easy to work with classically. And the flat cell geometries are looking pretty good, but the problem with those is the shape of the cells is rather ambiguous. So to come up with something better than this, we basically take the flat cell geometries and try to fix this ambiguity, and we come up with spinning geometries, which I'm going to introduce today. And these will possess a continuous frame field and a continuous connection. So the outline of the talk is first to review the twisted and flat cell geometries. I will then introduce some new angular momentum variables that can be associated to fluxes. We'll reduce the ambiguity in the flat cell edge shapes. So the flat cell geometry is formed by cells gluing together, sort of like a Reggie geometry. And we're going to try to reduce the ambiguity in the shape. And we'll show that the resulting edge shapes are compatible with the gluing maps that we use. And we'll conclude by discussing the results. Okay, so a twisted geometry is composed of a collection of polyhedra glued together along faces. Each face has some flux. The modulus of this flux gives you the area of the face, and the orientation gives you the orientation of the face. And in addition to the flux in each face, we have a holonomy, and this tells you how this gives you some gluing rule so that I can look at the same face from this cell, and if I look at it from this cell, it's related by this gluing rule by rotation given by the holonomy and a reversal of the orientation. And now these fluxes all define a polyhedron, so they satisfy this closure relation, which descends from the Gauss law that basically says the four faces have to form some sort of closed polyhedron. Now this geometry was shown recently to admit a torsionless connection. But it is discontinuous. And that shows up because while the areas have to match between the faces, the shape of the face is generally different. So these triangles could have different edge lengths even though the area is the same. Now in the flat cell geometry, we work with cells here as well, but here the cells are only diffeomorphic to polyhedra. And we assign to the faces a gluing map so that the closure of each of one face is mapped to the closure of another. And by that I mean that the boundary of the face maps to the boundary and the interior maps to the interior. And this is done in such a way that now not only do the areas match, but the faces also match in the shape. Now the price you pay is that the edges are no longer straight. Each of these cells possesses some coordinate function that maps you from the cell to some number in R3. And with these functions, we can define a metric. I'm putting here in bold everything that's an element of the SE2 algebra. And the dot product implies taking the trace of the two elements. So I'm going to use a vector notation for the SE2 elements. The coordinate functions between cells have to obey some gluing rules. So if we take a point x that's in the face, FCC primes, and now I want to look at where this point is in the cell C prime, that gets mapped to some new point. And the coordinate function in C prime is related to the coordinate function in C according to this gluing map, which is just a Poincaré transformation. So A is like a translation, and the holonomies are giving us a rotation. In this paper, we showed that these geometries are isomorphic to the loop gravity phase space, and twisted geometries are also isomorphic to the loop gravity phase space, so we can see these as being actually isomorphic to each other, the twisted geometry and the flat cell. And one way to see this is to take apart a flat cell geometry piece by piece, and then you can change, deform each piece into a polyhedron and come up with the twisted geometry. And it's important to recognize that now these geometries may have torsion. So there are two interesting subclasses of these geometries. The Reggie geometry is the case where torsion vanishes everywhere, and all of the faces of the cells are flat. And more generally, if we allow non-zero torsion on the edges of the cellular decomposition, and allow the faces to be curved, this is what we call a spinning geometry. In a Reggie geometry, we have a bunch of cells that are each polyhedra, but in the spinning geometry, the cell shapes are so far ambiguous. And what we're going to do next is try to fix this ambiguity. One can define fluxes associated to the faces using the coordinate functions. And allowing this definition is actually a result of the continuous Gauss law. And if we use the Gauss law coming from Stokes' theorem, we can take a differential out of this bracket. I should mention that this is a wedge product between the one forms and an SU2 product between the algebra components. And so this integral over the face FC C prime becomes an integral around the boundary. Now, fluxes are generally related with an angular momentum in loop quantum gravity due to their Poisson algebra. And this equation is now giving us some new relationship with angular momentum. If we reduce this into a sum over each link bounding the face, we then have a term for each link on the edge of a face. And we call these the link momenta. And parametrizing one of the links by a time parameter s, I can write the equation like this using the vector notation. And look at this. Here we have a position times a velocity. This is just an angular momentum.
So the face you're talking about is the face, just look on notation. Is the face in the graph or is the dual face around?
It's in a dual face, so this is all dual to the graph. Okay. And integrating along this L, we're now integrating the position times the velocity. And now, so the link momentum is actually like the integral of an angular momentum of a point particle in 3D gravity traveling along this world line, to use an analogy. Okay, so now we have some new reason that fluxes are related with angular momentum. And notice that these are defined only on the edges around the face. So the actual choice of face doesn't matter in defining the flux here. Everything is defined by the link that goes around it. This is due to the Gauss law. And defining these link momenta, any deformation of the links which keeps them fixed will also fix the fluxes. And now how can we fix the ambiguity in the edge lengths? So we just said the face doesn't really matter for the flux. Let's try to choose an edge shape. Well, in a Reggie geometry, they're all straight edges. So what is that? That's just the shortest distance between the two points at the ends. So let's minimize the edge lengths and see what happens. And we'll do this in a way that fixes the link momenta. So to do this, we introduce this action. Here we have, so this is a sum over terms, one for each link, where we integrate over the coordinate function. This basically gives us the length of the edge. And we add a constraint, which is fixing the link momenta to be some set value. And omega here is just a Lagrange multiplier. Bearing this action, we get an equation of motion for each link. And the solution is a helix. A helix, one way to visualize it is drawing it around a cylinder. So we can write the solution for a helix like so, where C is at the base point of the cylinder in the middle, R0 is some radial vector. The time parameter is phi, which is the angle that you're going around the axis omega. And I'm going to call Z phi the end point of the helix and Z naught the start. And this parameter K is telling you when you go around a certain angle phi, k tells you how high up the axis you go. So it's sort of the radial component, or the axial component. And one other thing to notice is that you can form an orthonormal basis if you know omega hat and r naught. So this will give you, and then if you take omega hat times cross product with r naught, that gives you a third vector. And so I'm going to call this the helix basis. Now I've got quite a few equations written here.
This is a link that connects two nodes.
A link that
so
connects two nodes.
So you're assuming that there's no extrinsic curvature between these two nodes, so you're taking a common R3 frame. And that's
this is the view from one cell. You could...
Well, there's a cell around one node and a cell around the other.
Okay, and this action is in... So for each link, I've chosen one cell to look at, okay, to look at the link from. And with a proper...
So by link, do you mean the boundary of the triangle?
Yes. A link is in the boundary of a face. With
can you draw a diagram? Because you're confusing, people are confusing the triangulation. Now maybe on the backboard.
I've got this one. So this is dual to the graph. Okay, one of these edges is a link.
That the experts are confused. So the best experts are... the most confused.
No, because they know too much. That's why they're too smart. If you know less, you don't.
Okay, so I'm calling this thing here a link. These are three links bounding a face. Okay, I may also call them edges. I'm using the terms interchangeably.
5 minutes.
Okay, 5 more minutes. Where were we? Okay, so we had an equation of motion for each link. And the point I want to make here is that, okay, one point I'm going to call D the displacement vector between the endpoints of the nodes. And you can write the link momentum using the angular momentum analogy again. I can split this up into an orbital part and a spin part. Now, the orbital part is what you would get for a straight link. So this is the Reggi term. And this S part is zero when the link is straight. But you get some contribution from to the spin whenever the link is not straight. So here I've got the radius of the cylinder again, this parameter k, which is telling you how your axial speed as you go around, phi, which is the total angle divided by 2 actually, and the helix basis, which I've written as sigma. So sigma 0 is the axis of the helix, and sigma phi is the perpendicular component. Now, the important part from this is just that I can write S and D in terms of R, K, phi, and the helix basis. Okay, so I've got this map from these parameters into Z naught, D, and S. So the displacement and the spin component. Now, for any D and S, can we invert this map? If we take D and S as given, we can find rather quickly that RK and the helix basis can be written in terms of DS and the angle phi that you go around in the helix. And the problem boils down to solving some big equation where now R is written in terms of phi and K is in terms of phi. F and G are those functions of phi in the previous slide. So to solve this, let's plot one of them just to show you an example. And now this is intersecting 0 many times. It actually intersects 7 times, which means for these values of the parameters, there are 7 different helices that would correspond to this displacement and the spin component. And checking over some wide range of these components numerically, we find that there's always at least one solution, and usually there's many solutions. So this means there is a helix for any D and S, and generally many. So now let's look at what happens over a cell. Given D and S, I can always find the helix for each edge. And in fact, there are many choices of D and S for any given set of fluxes. And each choice would lead to different helices in the boundaries. So is there some way that we can try to restrict this choice? Or what restrictions come into play in our choices of D and S when we try to glue these things together? So let's consider a single link at the intersection of many cells. Okay? Recall that we had these gluing relations between the coordinate functions given by a Poincaré transformation. but also that this point X gets mapped to a different point as seen from the neighboring cell. If we now take the point X to be on this link that's common to all the cells and go right around the link and come back to the same point, we obtain a constraint on these gluing maps that we need this to be satisfied, where the capital H is composed of all the holonomies going around the link from cell to cell, and A is composed of the translations, and the holonomies also get mixed up in there. Okay, so in general, we have to have something, some maps that solve this. And look again, we find the helix again. So this had to be a helix from the gluing maps alone without even looking at this minimization. What we find is that the axis of rotation has to be given by this capital H. So the capital H is some holonomy that gives you a rotation around an axis omega hat, and it's got some angle theta that you're rotated by. So we have to rotate around the axis that the holonomies tell us it is, and then this, when we go around by a certain angle, we also have to move up the axis a certain amount, and this we'll fix what the translation A is once we know K. So now, given this restriction, can we always find some closed network of helices for any set of holonomy and flux data in the loop gravity phase space? So this is an open question that we're going to work on for the next installment of this project. So to conclude, I presented to you a new form of geometrical representation of the loop gravity phase space. They're isomorphic to twisted geometries. They are continuous and have torsion and curvature supported on a one-dimensional network of helices. And the axes of these helices are defined by the holonomies that go around the link. So in going from one cell to another, there's a holonomy on the faces, and when you go all the way around, you get some holonomy that tells you what the axis of the helix has to be. Now, this is the most general cellular space that has a vanishing curvature and torsion outside of the edges, which came as somewhat of a surprise to us because you naturally just assume Reggie geometry is the most natural piecewise flat decomposition. But if you allow for torsion on the edges, we find that these spinning geometries are allowed, and Reggie geometries are the case when the helix is sort of degenerate, when the helix becomes a straight edge. This is getting as close to allowing us to define a continuous connection, a specific continuous connection and frame field for any set of holonomy and flux data. And what this opens the door to is taking the Hamiltonian for GR, written in terms of the Ashtekar variables, so writing what the scalar constraint is, using this gauge that we have, and drawing on this to try to derive some dynamics in terms of holonomies and fluxes. And this not only works as some motivation to help with the derivation, but it also provides a check if we are able to come up with some dynamics in terms of these variables. Okay. And to close, this is a picture of what one of the faces would look like, bounded by two helices and a straight edge. Thank you.
We don't have much time, but I see that the experts are very excited. So.
Can we ask questions? Or
Simone.
Right. Oh, okay, then ask. I may, but I'll ask just a quick question. In this picture, you say that you want to go towards continuous connections and frame fields. Can you give us an intuition of how you would see the extrinsic geometry arising between these helices? Or this is too soon to say?
Do you mean on the faces, or so?
You tell me what to expect.
Okay, so what should happen is that viewing this as a spatial slice of a space-time, if I take the exterior derivative of the frame field, what one finds is that this is non-vanishing along the faces, but it vanishes inside all of the cells. So you can see, you know, the K terms drop out of the continuous Hamiltonian right away. And also the F the curvature of the connection is zero. So this brings in a real simplification in the continuous Hamiltonian, where maybe we can write things in terms of what's going on in the boundaries of these cells. And this is where the extrinsic curvature lies, is on the faces as well as the edges. Yeah?
No, a very short question.
Those twisted geometries, they have torsion or not?
Twisted geometries, they admit a torsionless connection. That was shown.
Was there this paper by Carlo Al, Wolfgang Thun, which they admit this torsionless connection?
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. Yeah, it admits a torsionless connection. Torsionless. And that's the paper I referred to.
Discontinuous. So the usual picture is that twisted geometry are discontinuous, torsionless.
Yeah.
Here we have continuity, full continuity.
With torsion.
With torsion, yeah.
Torsion.
But that's the frame field is discontinuous in the twisted geometry.
At the end of the day, continuity is preferable. And torsion is a nice feature.
Yeah. Okay, so let us thank the speaker. Put it in your pocket.
Is it switch on?
Probably should be on.
How do I traverse the slides?
Sorry?
How do I traverse the slides? Okay. Hello, everybody. I'm Madhavan, and the title of my talk is Loop Groups and Quantum Gravity. So I'm going to be talking about the role played by loop groups in developing a quantum theory of gravity. So this is not about Wilson loops or spin networks or edges or links or intersecting Wilson loops. This is about plain old loops generated by an ordinary group of loops. So this is the outline of my talk. The first part deals with an introduction to loop groups. What a loop group. It's about what a loop group is, examines their properties, and we undertake some formal constructions on them as well. And next, we motivate why loop groups are being used to develop quantum gravity, what their link with general relativity is, and what the link with quantum theory is. And afterwards, we'll be looking at some observations made by attempting a theory of this. So first we start from the beginning. A loop group, say LG, is a group of maps from the circle S1 onto a topological group G. So what we do with this loop group is we introduce a new equivalence relation called the cobordism. Those into algebraic topology would have heard of that. So we have a subgroup of this loop group with that equivalence relation. So you should have seen the simplest cobordism, a pair of pans. So this is to describe something known as the Chasse-Sullivan product that comes up in string topology. And the virtue of that is the composition there and the operator that comes with it turns the loop homology into a BV Gerstein-Haber algebra. And that, as you know, is a Lie superalgebra with a Z2 grading. Mm-hmm. Next is, So with the help of that composition, we introduce new products. The first one is what I call the vertical composition. We'll get to what that gamma is over there. And alpha and beta are loops. And the next one is a horizontal composition. These things may seem a little ill-defined at first, but we'll see a little later what they actually mean. And another one called the total product. Okay, so what have these loop products got to do with anything? So we define that gamma over there as a path ordered exponential of a quantity I call the holonomy average of the two loops, alpha and beta. And the connection there, the phi AB, is written down is defined in a quantization compatible manner. And after that, we propose that the curvature of the connection is the integral over the loop space, that is omega g, of the total product that we saw down there. So this seems a little absurd, but...
So can you explain the integral over a loop?
The loop space. Sorry?
What do you mean?
What?
You say, you write an integral over alpha, which is a loop.
Yes. Okay. The alpha
integral
that...
is a two-form, because then it's dx, dx.
Yeah.
How do you integrate a two-form?
No, that is a one-form. Alpha cross, I'm integrating over a one form.
Okay, so what one form are you?
The product there is a one form.
What?
The product there is a one form.
Can you show me the pointer which there? Yeah, but up there in the top formula.
This is the one?
No. Go back to the first line of your formula.
Okay. Yeah, this?
We have integral of phi b dx a dx b.
Yeah.
What does that mean?
That this is the connection. Phi a b is the connection, and I'm integrating over that.
But a connection is a one form.
Yeah, a connection is a one form. Mm-hmm. Oh, it should have been dx a. OK, I get it. Yeah, I get what you're saying. It should have been phi a dx a. OK, I'll correct that. Yeah, so, okay, I'm sorry. That should have been phi a dxa. Here we propose, the curvature of the connection is that. So we provide a concise, sketchy proof of what that should be like. So we do that by defining an inner product on the group with the help of this. And that's a pseudo-differential operator this delta. And for the loop space, the S is the Sobolev space parameter. And that expansion becomes trivial for real values. So here it takes a value half. So so this is the symplectic form that is defined in such a manner as the inner product. So from here it is easy to see that the curvature of the one form this is justified. So now we get to an important part of the talk, that is, we motivate why loop groups are being used, what they have to do with quantum gravity. First, we examine the link with general relativity. So, as you know, loop groups have a manifest Kala structure, and so does the loop space. So, if you impose a Ricci flatness condition on it, it incurs Calabi-Yau properties. And there's this theorem called the Campbell-Magad embedding theorem that allows you to embed n-dimensional spacetimes in n plus 1-dimensional Ricci flat manifolds. So you can see that if you move to higher dimensions, Calabi-Yau, inside of that we can embed a spacetime. So that, yeah. And now the link with quantum mechanics. Loop groups can be thought of as groups of operators on Hilbert space. This is in a nice book, nice rendition, Presley-Segal. And another useful property of loop groups, or rather the Grassmannian, is Pluhar embedding, that is a canonical basis. You'll be writing the Grassmannian of the Hilbert space in terms of these Pluhar coordinates. Okay, so here we have just put up some definitions, which you can get from a textbook, but we'd just be reminding you of them. Rodolfo Gambini and Jorge Pullin have a nice rendition of this. So if you remember the proposition that allowed me to write a curvature, in terms of that total product there, scalar curvature, so one should be authorized to define an action like this. So yeah, following this, we vary that kind of action to obtain the equations of motion here. And we derive what I call the momenta. So that's written like this. We have a calculation for this, expanding in terms of the loop derivatives that I'd shown previously. That is this. Okay, now we define another quantity, which I call velocity, as the following. The Ix is the interior product. And with this, we define another quantity, which we like to call energy, as a total product between these two. If you remember that, I'll just get back there. Yeah, this one. Between the two new quantities, so that's what I call energy. There's a total product between the momenta and the velocity over the loop space. So an integral over that. And all of these integrals are well defined because one can find a natural measure that's called a Brownian loop measure, but I will not go into those finer details here. It's just to give an idea as to how loop groups can be used for quantum gravity. See the link. So yeah, here are some key observations that I'll be presenting in this section. Okay, so the first one is higher dimensions. Why? You can see it from the embedding theorem that I talked of previously, the Campbell-Maggard embedding theorem that allows one to embed an n-dimensional spacetime into an n+1 dimensional Ricci flat manifold. So if I have a 5-dimensional Calabi-Yau manifold, I can embed a 4-dimensional spacetime. And also, due to the definition of this energy function, that would remind you of the total product we saw previously, which was just the structure equation for that. That is the curvature of the connection. So due to this, we see that if we move to higher dimensions, it is possible to prove by mathematical techniques that the momenta and velocity behave as Cobourne loops in dimension 5 and above, because 5 is the dimension least for which a technique I used to prove this. It's called the Whitney trick. So that works only in dimension 5 and above. So yeah, you can be assured that that holds. So we write down curvature in terms of these momenta and velocity as follows. So that should appear familiar. Yeah, so we get back to this. As I said, the loop space omega g, it has a manifest Kahler structure. And this combined with Ricci flatness leads to Calabi-Yau properties. And yeah, written down the scalar curvature again. And the averaged scalar curvature is given by that total product. So this is to define the energy flow on the manifold. That's given by this, the Calabi-Yau energy, where omega is the Kahler form there. And with this, there's an energy operator that's associated with the loop group, and that, so you can relate that to this. As in the energy flow, you can relate with the energy operator, and that's the expectation value on the right-hand side. Okay, now we discuss quantizability. We have this interesting setup where you can create an action, you can vary it, you can obtain the dynamics, you can get GR. So now what you want to do is quantize it. And as I mentioned earlier, the connection was defined in a quantization compatible manner. And now getting back to the Pluhar embedding that I was talking about, what that does is that creates a holomorphic embedding that can be constructed from the loop space onto the projective Hilbert space. So that's the polarization of the Hilbert space. Yeah. So now we may end up with an overcomplete basis as before, but the equivalence relation on this is you don't really have any group identities that would lead to overcompleteness. You've gotten rid of those, but you have cobordism as an equivalence relation. So you want to sidestep that as well. So what you do is okay. Fine, thank you. So you introduce cobordism invariance. There are knots. Vladimir Turov has done some nice work on that, constructing knot polynomials that are invariant under cobordisms. So yeah, like I said, it's necessary to make void the effect of the group equivalence relation of the loops, yeah, the cobordism. So I've reached the end of my talk. The main messages I'd like you to carry is that loop groups can be used as a means for quantum gravity. And prospective. I have not really discussed the quantization procedure in depth, but a prospect for that is Berezin-Toplitz quantization, And what we've done here is we've sidestepped an overcomplete basis. We've not tackled the problem head on, but we've just gotten rid of that. Some ambiguities that can arise in this theory is relating to the fact that the integration measure, we'll have to look into those details a little more, but is the classical loop theory really general relativity? And when I was talking about the cobordism between the momenta, what I call the momenta and the velocity, that's not unique. So that could be cobordant with other loops. So there's a problem that lies there. And yeah, that's just a postscript. That's just put up for fun. Yeah, that's it. Thank you. Yes.
Yeah, so this goes over my head mathematically, but let me see if I just understand the setting, the statement you make. You start with a loop group, and you build a theory on the loop group of some group, and you claim to extract its generality.
Yes.
So what group are you, what group is it, the loop group?
An arbitrary Lie group.
Arbitrary Lie group.
Yes.
And how does a four-dimensional manifold arise from the loop group of an arbitrary Lie group?
What I didn't say it arised. I said a four-dimensional manifold can be embedded into a into the loop space.
The loop space is the space of the loop group, the space of mappings.
Yes.
Of
yes.
One into the group.
Yes. So what I'm saying is that if that is, say, a five-dimensional Calabi-Yau manifold, then by this theorem, the Campbell-Margaret embedding theorem, one can embed a four-dimensional space-time into it. I'm not saying that it arises naturally.
Okay, but back up a little bit. The loop group is infinite dimensional.
Yes, the loop group is infinite dimensional, but the loop space is not.
What's the loop space?
I'm sorry, I didn't get your question.
When you say, what is the loop space? What's the definition?
Oh, okay, okay. So, yeah, when you deal with traditional loop quantum gravity, you're assuming holonomy equivalence, I think. Hoop group, I think. In that case, you literally mean the same thing when you say loop space and loop group, but you don't hear in the loops. The loop space is the space of maps from the circle onto a manifold, but that need not be infinite dimensional.
But it is, why?
Only the loop group is infinite dimensional, not the loop space. That can take any dimension into one.
Okay, we need to discuss.
Okay, sure.
Okay, are there more questions?
Can you adapt this to the coupling of matter? For example?
Coupling of matter, okay. This is, to be honest, it's very premature. I haven't even figured out, I've just figured out a part of the dynamics, but yeah, I haven't investigated those things as of yet. Thank you.
Okay, let us think. The next speaker is MIT. And the title of the talk, Deformed Phase Space for Hyperbolic. So this is, you need to put this somewhere in your pocket. Somewhere. And this is the pointer. And
so this is a pointer? Okay, thanks. Okay, thanks very much. Hi, everyone. So I'm going to talk about the deformed phase space for hyperbolic surfaces. So I'm working on this with Valentin Boson, Florian Girelli, and Etera Levin. And in fact, it's a work still in progress. So as you will see, there are still many open questions. So first, why do we want to deform the phase space of loop quantum gravity? So one of our motivations is a recent result I obtained with Florian Girelli. And so on the paper which is just which just appeared today on archive, you can so we consider some spin network state defined with UQ SU2 as a gauge group instead of SU2. And then we build some geometrical observables such as the area operators or angle operator, and which are diagonalized by this Q deform spin network. And then we show that these geometric observables characterize some quantum hyperbolic discrete geometries. So then if you relate this Q, the deformation parameter, to the to the cosmological constant. This shows a first insight that quantum group could be used in the context of loop quantum gravity in order to introduce the cosmological constant into the game. And it also points out that maybe we should deform already the kinematical Hilbert space of loop quantum gravity. So of course, when you do the usual canonical analysis of loop quantum gravity, the cosmological constant appears only in the Hamiltonian constraint, and it doesn't modify the kinematical Hilbert space. So the idea here is to restart from the beginning and to modify the phase space of loop quantum gravity and try to find symplectic structure which possesses Poisson-Li group symmetries. Because we know that Poisson-Li group symmetries are then quantized as a quantum group. So what we want to do is to define a symplectic structure on SL2C, which are going to be parameterized by the parameter kappa, a real parameter kappa. So this parameter is going to be then related to the cosmological constant. And then the usual SU2 symmetry is going now to be a SU2 Poisson-Li group symmetry. So after quantization, what we will get is a UQ SU2 gauge symmetry as wanted. So here is the plan. So what I want, first I'm going to recall the canonical phase space for loop quantum gravity. Then I'm going to introduce our deformed phase space. And finally, I'm going to show that already at the classical level, we can have some geometrical insights. So first, in loop quantum gravity, so at the kinematical level, if we consider a fixed graph, the Hilbert space associated to this graph, gamma, can be interpreted as the quantization of the classical space, the cotangent bundle over SU2. Then this cotangent bundle is usually parameterized by a group element, G, and Lie algebra element, so it's the holonomy flux variable, and the symplectic structure is given by this Poisson brackets. Then the main symmetry we are interested in is the SU2 symmetry, at least for today, and then which is of course implemented by the Gauss constraint. So the Gauss constraint can be written in terms of these flux variables, and it implements the SU2 invariance at each vertex. Okay. Then of course, if you want to have the complete theory, so you need to of course consider the vectorial Hamiltonian constraint, or in the simplest case of 2+1 dimensional gravity, which is a topological gravity, it can be seen only as a flatness constraint. So now what are we going to do? We are going to modify the phase space. So instead of the cotangent bundle over SU2, we are going to consider the group SL2C and the nature of the symmetry. So instead of standard SU2 transformation, now we are going to consider SU2 Poisson Li group symmetries. So why are there Poisson-Li group symmetry? Because in fact, if you want to have your symplectic structure invariant under this SU2 transformation now, you will need to impose some non-trivial Poisson bracket satisfied by this symmetries. Then of course, so now we will have some new variables, some new symmetries. So we will need to write a new Gauss constraint and also a new flatness constraint. And then, of course, at the end, the question is, what do we get? Do we get gravity with a cosmological constant? So this is still an open question, because to answer this question, we need to understand the continuum limit. And as I'm going to explain it, it's not so simple. So now, here is the deformed phase space. So we focus on a one-oriented edge of a network. And so, as I said, the phase space now is the group SL2C, which contains SU2 and its dual, so the special Borel group. And a group element of SL2C, G, is then labeled by a special unitary matrix and a lower triangular matrix. And it is defined thanks to the Iwasawa decomposition. So G can be written as the product of L and U, with L a triangular matrix and U SU2 matrix. So if you compare with the previous phase space, so the cotangent bundle of over SU2, you see that now the momentum space is not anymore the cotangent space, but it's curved, so it's hyperboloid. Okay. So on this phase space, now we introduce a symplectic structure following Marmo, Simony, and Stern, and you can see that we get a non-trivial quadratic Poisson structure, where R now is a classical R matrix. So in fact, this phase space is really a deformation of the usual phase space of loop quantum gravity, and this can be seen when you take the deformation parameter to zero. So the R matrix is defined in terms of depends on this deformation parameter, as well as the triangular matrix. So L, in fact, is the exponential of the flux, and it's generated by some modified boost. So tau I is a modified boost, which can be expressed in terms of the Pauli matrices. So when kappa goes to zero, in fact, you really recover the usual phase space for the flux and holonomy variables. So then here we have chosen to use the left Iwasawa decomposition, and we could have chosen the right one, but this is just in fact equivalent to switch orientation of the edge. Okay, so now let's come to the symmetry. So we have two kinds of symmetry: the rotation generated by SU2 group elements, and translation generated by multiplication by triangular matrices. So these symmetries now are Poisson-Lie group symmetries, because if you want that your symplectic structure is invariant under this transformation must satisfy some non-trivial Poisson bracket between among themselves. So then if you consider infinitesimal rotation, you can see that the rotation is generated by the Poisson bracket with the Hermitian matrix L, L dagger. So indeed, it's this triangular matrix that we are going to use to build our Gauss constraint, that and the Gauss constraint is going to implement this SU2 invariant at a given vertex. So now I'm going to consider a vertex with n edges, all incoming. And the Gauss law is very simple. It's just the product of the triangular matrices. So now be careful, the order is important. So it's really L1 times L2 times Ln is equal to identity. Then it's easy to check that these constraints are first class constraints. You just compute the Poisson bracket, and the Poisson bracket vanish on the constraint surface. So we have first class constraint. Then you know that in the standard case, the Gauss constraint has a nice geometrical interpretation. For example, if you consider a three-valent vertex, to be simple, you know that the Gauss constraint is equivalent to a closure constraint for a triangle. Okay, so from a trivalent vertex, you really construct a triangle. So now the question is, what is the geometrical interpretation that we have in this case? So I'm going to focus on 3D 2 plus 1 gravity, but so it's the Euclidean one. And since we are working with so the deformation parameter is real, kappa is real, it will be useful, relevant for the 3D Euclidean gravity with a negative cosmological constant. So for my geometrical interpretation, I need the Cartan decomposition. So my triangular matrix can be written as a product of a pure boost in the SL2C group, and H, which is a SU2 matrix. So here, B is written in its spinorial representation. So, and its rapidity is equal to 2B. And then its boost direction is given by this normalized B vector. Okay. So now I'm going to focus on a three-valent vertex. So N equals 3. So my Gauss constraint simplify as L1 times L2 times L3 equal identity, and I can rewrite it using this B and H variables, so my boost and SU2 matrices. And in fact, I can even rewrite this equation as a product of three pure boost times a rotation. So, because you know that the conjugation by a SU2 matrix of a pure boost is still a pure boost. So then I can rewrite in three different ways this equation. And so if I focus on the first one, you know that a boost is going to define a point on the hyperboloid. So starting from identity or the origin, with B1 I define a point, and with B2 I define another point. And what this relation tells me is just that this has to close as a triangle. Okay, and then the two other equations are just a translation with a boost of this triangle. So now you know we know also that the hyperbolic triangle is totally specified by its three angles, and you have seen that I can write in three different ways my Gauss law, so given by the previous slide equation 1, 2, and 3. And so now will give me the three value of the angles of my and which defines my triangle. So if I focus on the first equation and take the trace of this equation, what I get is really a hyperbolic cosine law for a triangle defined with edge lengths given by 2b1, 2b2, and 2b3. And I have here one value the value of one angle, so theta 1, 2, where cos theta 1, 2 is defined with the scalar product of b1 with b2. And b1 and b2 are my, my tangential vector to this triangle. And then, of course, using 2 and 3, I will deduce the value of my two other angles, which define uniquely my hyperbolic triangle. Okay, so this is the geometrical interpretation of this Gauss law. So you see that already here we have some hyperbolic geometry arriving. And so now for the flatness constraint, so it's just a proposition. So it's a proposition because this constraint is quite nice because it's a first class constraint and it's SU2 gauge invariant. But yeah, we don't really know yet what is the interpretation of this constraint, so I won't say much about it. But if you consider, for example, this simple network with these three vertices, you know at each vertex we have the closure constraint. So each vertex defines me a hyperbolic triangle. And you see that my flatness constraint says that U3 times U2 times U1 is equal to identity. It's just, in fact, it just tells me the way I'm going to glue together my triangles. Okay, so I won't add anything more here. So here, the conclusion. So what do we have? So we presented here a new phase space parameterized by a real parameter kappa, which is going in the quantization or in the continuum limit, is going to be related to the cosmological constant. Then we have some proposition for the constraint, and already using this constraint we can have some geometrical insights, and we characterize some hyperbolic geometries. And of course there are much more to explore. First of all, of course, the continuum limit to see if we can really understand this as gravity plus the cosmological constant. And then of course it will be also interesting to look at the solution for a given topology when we have the Gauss and flatness constraint. Then the next step we are interested in is, of course, to find the spinor variable, because in the work I did with Florian Girelli, we already have the quantized version of this variable, so it will be interesting to have the classical equivalent. And of course, then to understand what is the quantization process. Okay, thank you.
Questions? Silone.
can you also do lambda positive? If I understood correctly, you're just looking at lambda negative. Is there a technical reason, or is it just a choice?
No, it's just that so for the for the 3D case, since we are dealing with a deformation parameter which is real, then at the quantum level it's going to be also a Q deform. The Q is going to be real, so it's not going to be Q root of unity. So for the 3D case, this corresponds to the Euclidean case with gamma negative. But then in 4D case, if we are dealing with the Lorentzian case, we want to have a Q real, so it's going to be relevant for the 4D case with the Lorentzian signature.
And in
but,
yeah.
Sorry to continue, but in 3D you also have the same formalism for the Lorentzian case and lambda positive, right?
Yeah, but then it's not the same. It's not the same group. It will be SU1. So here we are dealing with SU2. So then it's also relevant for when we are doing the canonical approach of loop quantum gravity in 4D, because it's SU2 plus. But in, for then for 3D, if you want the Lorentzian, you need SU11. So.
Okay. Are there more questions?
There's time just to clarify, make sure that I'm following. So the idea is that so in, if you're in 2 plus 1, so let's look at SU2 as the covariant group. And the idea is that this cotangent bundle is isomorphic to SL2C, but this is also isomorphic with this saga decomposition, which suggests a completely different Poisson structure than the one of T star of SU2. And that's your input, and that's what you're taking into account, and you're interpreting now this new Poisson structure as hyperbolic triangles. This is kind of the logic I follow, or not so much?
Yeah, I think so.
Oh, so your Poisson solution is not T star. It's
no, that's the point. Is this funny thing?
Yeah, using this R matrix.
It's a deformation of T star.
Yeah, it's a deformation
so
of T star.
This is the Drinfeld double.
The classical double. Yeah.
This is the classical double.
Yeah. Sorry?
It's a Drinfeld
double. The Hamiltonian.
Yeah, so the Hamiltonian we didn't.
So there's no dynamics.
For the moment, yes, there is no dynamics. Yeah, for the moment it's just kinematical, except that for.
Normally, lambda is in constraint. Now you remove lambda from the constraint, you put it directly in the kinematical
state. Yeah, already at the kinematical level. So then the Hamiltonian will change. It's not. Yeah.
Without lambda.
Sorry.
The Hamiltonian will be with lambda or without lambda.
I think it will be with lambda also, but it's just that lambda also appear already at the kinematical level. It's not just we have SU2 for the kinematic level, and then so it's going to be in the connection.
Yeah, it's going to be the curvature of the connection which you get from lambda.
Yeah.
So it will be no lambda in the no, it's inside the connection. So
the yeah. It's already.
Let us thank Mighty again. Next speaker is Giuseppe Sellaroli, and he will tell us about tensor operators for the Lorentz group in 2 plus 1. The opposite.
Okay, hello everyone. So I'm going to talk to you about Lorentz. The Lorentz group and tensor operators for this group. And in particular, and this is the work I'm doing with Florian, I'm going to use these tensor operators to implement the spinor approach in Lorentzian quantum gravity in 3D. So first of all, what is this spinor approach? It's a way to treat loop quantum gravity using these tensor operators, which I will define later. But at this point, we don't need it, because in 3-dimension Euclidean, or in 4-dimension, both Euclidean and Lorentzian, we have SU2 as a gauge group. And we can use actually an implicit construction of this spinor approach. And we can just use the Jordan-Zwinger construction. We don't need to explicitly see that we're using tensor operators. So the advantages of this approach are that we can get a closed algebra for the generators of the observables. In 3D, we can construct an Hamiltonian using these generators. And also, as we saw before, we can use the deformed quantum group to treat LQG with the cosmological constant. And in this theory, we can use tensor operators in general. And in particular, we can use the spinor approach to construct these observables. For SU2, this is what we do. We have this the SU2 algebra, as we all know, is generated by these operators. And we can rewrite them using the Zwinger-Jordan representation by introducing two harmonic oscillators, which I call A and B. These are just the annihilation and creation operators. And we can rewrite all the generators in this way. We'll get exactly the same spectrum and the same computational relations. So now, when we consider an intertwiner with n legs, we can introduce a couple of harmonic oscillators for each of the legs, which carry a representation of SU2. And we can write all of the observables using these operators, which we will see the special kind of tensor operators, they are scalar operators. The diagonal ones, the ones where I and is the same as J, which act on the same leg, will just give the area associated with the leg. Actually, the area if we are in 4D, otherwise it would be the length. And the total area would be the sum of all the operators for each one of the leg. So the action of these operators is to take one quantum of area from one of the legs and to put it to another leg. But they don't change the total area. And they generate a closed algebra, as I said before. These are the actual generators of the observables. And this algebra is UN. Now, can we do this for the Lorentz group? And so for the Lorentzian case, I'm only considering 3D at this point, because it's simpler to work with. So first of all, the group we will use, it's not actually the Lorentz group, but it's double cover. This is just like we use SU2 instead of the rotation group in three dimension. It's a Lie algebra. It's really similar to the one of SU2. As we can see, there's just this minus sign, which changes everything. And I used 0 instead of z because it didn't make sense to use z direction. And the Casimir is given by this expression. Again, this is really similar to the Casimir of SU2. And here I really mean this is the Minkowski color product. So this is the way the generators act on representations. This is really similar to the way that SU2 generators act on the representation. I don't expect you to remember this. This is just to show you this is similar to SU2. And as you can see, there's just, if you remember the functions from the SU2 representation, there's just a minus sign in here which changes, and another one in here. And this epsilon just specifies the parity of the representations. So it can be zero for bosonic representations and 1/2 for fermionic ones. And we don't need to explicitly say it every time. But in some representation, this is not specified by J. And so we need to put it there. So these are almost all of the reducible representations of SU2. There are three classes. There's a discrete. Actually, there are four classes, but I put two of them together. So the discrete series, which can be positive or negative, and this is specified the plus or minus. J can be minus 1/2, 0, 1/2, and so on, in steps of 1/2. And here, epsilon is given by J, so the parity is fixed by J, and we don't need to explicitly say it. And M can be any value, plus or minus in here, depends on if you're using the positive or negative series. Can be plus or minus J plus 1, J plus 2, and so on. And this goes up to infinity. So this is actually an infinite dimensional representation. Then we have the continuous series. J can be any complex number which is not an half integer. Actually, there are some half integers which we can consider. I just didn't put in there because they are difficult to read, because there's some problem with parities. And they don't appear in loop quantum gravity, so we don't really care about them. And ERM can be any, depending on the parity, can be any integer or any odd half integer. And there's the finite dimensional series, which is just the same as the SU2 representations. So gamma, I'm using a different notation to not to confuse them. So gamma and E are just the same as J, and mu is just the same as M. But for the finite dimensional case, I'm using gamma and mu to distinguish them. And so gamma can be 0, 1, 0, 1 half, 1, and so on. And mu can be anything from at integral steps from minus gamma to gamma. So as long as LQC at low quantum gravity is concerned, we only need the ones appearing in the Planck-Schneider decomposition, which are the discrete positive and negative series for J greater than 0. So the minus 1 half 1 doesn't enter this decomposition. And the continuous series only with J equals minus 1 half plus psi s, which s must be positive. And all of these representations are unitary and infinite dimensional. Some, not all of the continuous series representations are unitary, but all of the discrete series are unitary. And of course, the finite dimensional representations are all, apart from the trivial one, non-unitary, since this is a non-compact group. Now, I talked about tensor operators, but I didn't define them. So by tensor operators, we mean sets of operators, which would be the components of this tensor operator, which transform when we act with the group as covectors in a finite dimensional representation. In particular, if this finite dimensional representation is irreducible, then they will be reducible tensor operators. And so we define a rank gamma irreducible tensor operator as some components, so a set of 2 gamma plus 1 components, which transform as covectors in this representation, which I defined before, which is non-unitary. But this is not a problem because this is just the way the tensor transform. And at the Lie algebra level, this is the definition. This is actually really similar to the definition of tensor operators for SU2. And actually, the Lie algebra generators form a rank 1 tensor operator, which we can call vector operator. And this is given in components in this way. And moreover, the important thing, and this is why we want to use tensor operators to study loop quantum gravity, is that all the observables in loop quantum gravity are in one-to-one connection correspondence with Hermitian, because they must be Hermitian to be observables, scalar operators, which are just rank 0 tensor operators. An interesting property of tensor operators is that we can combine them together to get another tensor operator. And we can do this using the Clebsch-Gordan coefficients of the coupling of two finite dimensional representations. And this coupling is just the same as the coupling of the SU2 representation. So we get the same Clebsch-Gordan coefficients. And so explicitly, this quantity is just the mu component of a rank gamma tensor operator. So gamma and mu are given in here, but the Clebsch-Gordan coefficient. And so in the spinor approach to loop quantum gravity, what you actually want is to look for two one-half operators, which we call spinor operators. And we want to combine them to construct the J operators in this way. If we do this for SU2, we actually get the Swinger-Jordan representation, which we used before. But we're using tensor operators explicitly this time. For SL2R, we can do this for the discrete series representations. And this was already done by Swinger himself when he introduced this representation. But until now, it wasn't done for the continuous series. So this is actually the first piece of new work. And to fill this gap, we need to use the Wigner-Eckardt theorem, which is the other piece of new work. So the Wigner-Eckardt theorem is known for SU2, but it wasn't known until now for non-compact groups in general. So we know that tensor operators in SU2 have a particular in simple matrix elements. And this is the same happens for SL2R. So I'm only considering the continuous series at this moment, but we can prove this for the discrete series as well. So as long as J is not an half integer, But this is not a problem because, as I said, this never happens for spin networks. The matrix element of a tensor operators between continuous representations is given by this formula, which is actually the Wigner-Eckert theorem. And these B functions are the inverse Clebsch-Gordan coefficients of this coupling, the coupling of a non-unitary representations. This one is finite dimensional with an infinite dimensional unitary, or this can also be non-unitary, a representation. And these operators, these are just the reduced matrix elements, just as in the usual Wigner-Eckert theorem. And they don't depend on M and prime or mu. So they just depend on the form of the tensor operator and on the J and the parity of the representations. So the important thing is that these inverse Clebsch-Gordan coefficients satisfy these selection rules. So M prime must be the sum of M and mu. And then we have this selection rule for J prime. And so this simplifies all the possible non-zero matrix elements. And we can actually compute these functions. So once we find one of these reduced matrix elements, we can find all of the matrix elements of the tensor operators with different M prime in them. So one important remark is that when we use half integral operators, which is what we're looking for, we always get out of the Planck-Schell decomposition because of this. Since gamma is 1/2, we always get something which is doesn't stay itself and goes away from the Planck-Schell decomposition. So now, if we use this Wigner-Eckert theorem, we can construct actually the analog of the Schwinger-Jordan representation. And so we can actually see that we can write J plus, J minus, and J zero with these operators, which are really similar to an harmonic oscillator, but are not an harmonic oscillator anymore. And we are just using the transpose instead of the conjugate transpose. And so now we can write all observables using these color operators, which still form a UN algebra. And we get the same similar operators which still form a UN algebra together with these ones, if we also include the discrete series representations. Now, an important point about these operators is that even if they're scalar operators, they still takes us out of the spin network states. So we can actually use them directly, and they won't be observables, since they take an intertwiner and they take it out of the intertwiner space. So to construct observables, we must actually use products of these operators. So what is left to do, since this is still a work in progress, and there are some problems due to the fact that the AIJ operators take you out of the spin network, is that we know that in the SU2 case, we can take first order polynomials, so we can just sum the AIJs to get observables. So we can sum them so there will be Hermitian, and there will be scalar operators, and so there will be actually observables for the spin network. This doesn't happen in the Lorentzian case, and so we need to understand why. And then we would like to actually construct an Hamiltonian, just like as we can do for SU2, for the 3D Lorentzian case. Okay, so these are some references if you are interested. Thank you. I don't know. Actually, the reason why I'm using the Wigner-Eckert theorem is because I don't know anything about those operators. So you can actually guess those operators. They satisfy the right commutation relations. But since we know everything about the harmonic oscillator, we don't know anything about those operators. So if you wanted to actually find the spectrum of these A and A transpose operators, you don't know how to do this. But using the Wigner-Cartunum, I can actually see that they generate all of the states, all of the continuous representations of SL2R. So this is why I'm using the Wigner-Cartunum. Because with some creativity, you could say that you could introduce these operators with these commutation relations and define J plus, J minus, and J zero in this way, and they would just satisfy these commutation relations. So this will be fine, but we also need to know what the spectrum of these operators is, and we don't know this. But if you use tensor operators, we will see that these operators are just the components of a tensor operator. And so we can calculate using the Wigner theorem all of the matrix elements. And so we don't actually need to know their spectrum.
So can I think of A and B as just spinors, as a spinor, the two entries of which are just real numbers?
A and B are the components of a spinor. So there are two spinors. We wanted to find two 1/2 operators, and actually one is the transpose of the other. So there was only one independent spinor. And so these components, they will be like IA and minus IB transpose. So these A and B are the components of a spinor operator, which will have two components. So it is basically just like a spinor.
I cannot see more questions, so let us see.